VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, welcome back to The Ruck. The Six Nations are done and normal service is resumed. You know, normal stuff like Leicester being in danger of relegation, the laws of the game being completely reinvented, and Stephen Jones being stuck at Datchet. I'm Owen Slott. Today has another reunion feel to it. Alan Dimmock is back.
Hello.
Superstar scribe of Rugby World, Sam Peters, is back. Sunday Times campaigning rugby writer, who is, I see now, dismissed as part of the player welfare brigade, as if that's an insult. Well done, Sam.
Yeah.
Good to have you both back. One question for each of you. Al, every edition of Rugby World, you go on a trip to a club and you drink in the club culture, literally and metaphorically.
Yeah.
You tell us the sort of defining characteristics of whatever club this might be. So I want to ask if you could reinvent yourself as a rugby supporter in any part of the world, which would your club be?
Well, it's not every month. I wish it was every month, but unfortunately they won't let me do that.
I thought you'd get a massive piss out of a club every single month.
I mean, there have been some absolute crackers. I'd love to. I wish they would send me abroad more often. We were hoping to do one in Paris this weekend coming for their quarterfinal with Toulouse in the Champions Cup, but unfortunately Racing balked at that one, so we're going to Edinburgh instead. But the one I have enjoyed the most, and it's probably maybe not as a home supporter but as a visiting fan, Jersey was amazing. If I could go back there as often as possible, I would. I just had an incredible time. It was amazing.
Is that why every club goes there for its pre-season?
That's
just because it's fun.
Yeah, now we could wade into dangerous tour territory there about what happens when you go there for pre-season.
Yes,
and
no, there is some.
Who
is
might
some
wake up there in the cells? But
I also thought that Jersey was a sort of slightly staid retirement / pay no tax sort of venue.
Did you never watch Bergerac?
Yeah,
it's all good.
Bergerac. Let's not touch Bergerac. All right, so Jersey's the place for us to go.
Yeah,
Sam.
Yes.
In Paris last week at maybe one of the most important rugby world gatherings, world rugby gatherings ever. I don't even think that's hyperbole. So in Paris last week, there was a conference of many of the world's leading rugby administrators.
It's a symposium, wasn't it? That's the word that we're using.
Symposium. I actually started off with meeting and then upgraded it to conference, but symposium is right. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that, Al. But lots of the real cheeses there, many of them medics, many of them lawmakers, and the idea was to discuss how to change the game to make it safer. Big sort of blue sky discussions from what I gather. Now, you might say this was long overdue, but at least it's happened. And Sam, you were there. You've also led a campaign in the media to make the game safer. I think we'd all acknowledge it that you've are at the forefront of that campaign. After 3 days discussing that very topic in Paris, do you feel any brighter about the future?
I felt quite tired at the end of it. There was a lot of dense detail and a lot of sort of scientific analysis, which I think rugby is really only at the beginning of its kind of journey upon. But whether it turns out to be the most important meeting, symposium, whatever we call it in rugby history, I think will remain to be seen. It was definitely very encouraging.
But it was the fact to me that they were actually prepared to say, hang on a sec, we just need to look at this with a fresh eye and go, you know, what can we change, rather than let's stick with what we've got and
Yeah, no, there's definitely an appetite to go, you know, do we have to make some fairly radical changes to the game in order to work upon what is, we're told, is an evidence-based approach? I mean, how much evidence there actually is around injury data? I mean, certainly the RFU hold now a pretty significant sort of amount of data, but the other countries, what was evident to me, have a very, very long way to catch up on this. But absolutely, big picture, general consensus that the game needs to work very, very hard to reduce the severity of injuries, reduce the number of concussions that are suffered on the pitch, and just in itself as a kind of cultural shift from maybe 5-6 years ago, that's pretty significant.
Yeah. Thanks, Sam. We will talk about that properly at more length sort of further down the programme. But we do also have a special new guest this week. In the coaching world, this man is considered so much the coming man of the profession that Seamy couldn't conquer the world fast enough. He was an England coach under Eddie Jones, age only 31. That wasn't good enough for him. He left of his own accord to try and grow and learn more elsewhere. He was the head coach of Bordeaux in the top 14 by the age of 33, which is fairly incredible. So this is Rory Teague. Rory, brilliant to have you here. Thank you very much for coming. Is it fair to say that Bordeaux couldn't actually handle the pace and the extent of change that you wanted to bring in?
It's probably quite a fair summary of what happened there. I think, you know, we could talk specifically about Bordeaux. I think it's probably French rugby in general. You just mentioned there, like, England seem to have the most data, you know, in terms of injuries, and I think it's it just shows how far ahead the game is here in England and potentially how far it is behind. So yeah, I did want to put some, what I would call, alongside the other coaches, some really basic foundations in place. But as you know, the French do like to resist and dig their heels in. So
you,
I
put
guess
it politely,
that's a good thing though.
So I guess essentially politics won in the end. You know, that's not me saying that I couldn't have done things slightly differently, or, you know, as you said, maybe gone a little bit slower, but in a results-driven competition where things are very much focused on the short term,
yeah,
you know, there was sort of two sides to, you know, we have to. I knew what we're trying to build for a long-term focus, but, you know, essentially there is presidents' egos and some crazy supporters involved, which do sort of chuck some ingredients into the mix, so to say.
So the good news from that is that you're not now at Bordeaux, so you are here on the podcast today. So well done, us.
There we are.
Exactly. Yeah, we're the winners.
So thanks to Bordeaux for allowing me to come to
you. Yeah, no, that's great news. I think it's fair to say, we won't grill you on it on air, but it's probably fair to say that it's by the start of next season or next season, you'll be doing a similar-ish job somewhere else, and you're just in the process of working out what that's going to be.
Exactly, yeah, that's the plan. I'm very open-minded, and by no means am I saying I am at this age now a director of rugby head coach. I'm keen to learn and you know, try different experiences, hence the reason why I went to try and coach in a foreign language over in France. So, you know, whatever comes my way, I'm very open and, you know, but cautious about taking the right opportunity, because I know that the next one's got to be the right one, and where that is and what it is and whoever it's with, you know, I'm really keen to get back into it at some stage.
You mentioned what it was like in France. How much of a surprise was that to you, having seen various different coaching setups around England, and then you dive in there? And
when you ask that question, the first thing that jumps to my mind is emotion. So French rugby is built on this emotional roller coaster. So the home and away mentality drives performance week in, week out. So you know, you're going away, for example, to Stade Francais. The whole training week has a different atmosphere to a home game. And it wasn't until sort of maybe 4 or 5 games into taking over last year, I asked one of the players, I said, why do we perform like this at home and then we play like that away? And, you know, he's very, very, very open, and I was actually surprised that he exposed himself in front of his peers. And he actually said that the reason why we play so well at home is because there's too much shame involved of losing at home. Whereas for an Anglo-Saxon, that probably has a you can relate to that a very small amount, but I don't think there's any Premiership teams that get on the bus at the weekend that go away thinking, oh, you know, we're just going to take our medicine here and don't worry about it, we'll put
it's
our strong
totally
team
different out. Mindset, isn't it? And every time someone says that about a French rugby, I don't know about you guys, but I just think that's it takes quite a lot to get your head around that they would go away and it doesn't mean so much, or they don't go away thinking,
particularly in 2019.
Yeah. Martin Johnson always used to talk about this when he was England coach, actually. Whether he went publicly about it, I don't know, but he certainly did sort of in conversations off the record, where he'd just say, you know, it's a very tribal sort of basic instinct type defend your patch, defend your caveman instinct kind of thing. And, you know, I think there's research that shows that like testosterone levels are higher in players when they play at home, because it is this sort of very basic instinct that's sort of goes back many, many moons. But I think it's evolved in English rugby, certainly, and it's a very different mentality now.
Yeah, the pride in being able to go away and sack someone at their own away from home, and I mean, that's a massive thing in our rugby, isn't it?
It's a big driver, I think, for teams in England.
But do you struggle to sell that to your French players, or do you?
It was a tough sell, but it was something that was quickly brushed under the carpet, as if to say it's like the elephant in the room, but right. Don't talk about it because it's the way it is. It's not going to change, and that's. But I think, you know, slowly but surely over time, I think they'll begin to break the mold. You know, you see Montpellier now have picked up a couple of wins on the road, one away in Toulon, and then they won away in Pau, and Toulouse, you know, credit to their season so far, I think they're doing fantastic. But I believe why they're doing one is because they've said, look, this is our identity, this is the way we do it, and we're going to go hell for leather, and we're going to put everything we can into it, and they've built something which takes time, etc. So yeah, the time isn't always on your side in France. So yeah,
unless you're Jack Brunel.
Yeah, Jack seems to have.
Yeah, but the Wayne's all right. I don't know. It's take and give. You know?
Doesn't that Brunel, or is part of the mafia?
That Brunel appointment, in so many ways, encapsulates. I mean, we could sit here and sort of slate French rugby for quite a long time.
We need a special programme for that.
But I mean, that Brunel appointment.
This is the slating French rugby. Stuart
Barnes will come on that one.
I mean, everyone, I think everyone, probably inside and outside of France, must have groaned when they saw that appointment, because it was just so lacking in kind of progressive thought. And, you know, everyone knows that the French national team need real significant change in the way they approach the game, and, you know, a different type of thinking. And that appointment just was so
maybe one of the few people who didn't groan at that appointment was Rory, because
bit of a double-edged sword, that.
So you were at Bordeaux working under Jacques Brunel.
Yeah, I was backs coach. Yeah, looking after the attacking backs.
He gets a France job, and you get promoted into his job.
Yeah, basically.
Can we ask you for the non-PC version, or whatever version? What's your take on Jack? Because he clearly has qualities. You don't get promoted without something, and you work with him and sort.
Well, I think so PC version. I think him and Bernard go back.
What's the un-PC version?
It's good to have some familiarity around you when you're building a staff. So I guess Bernard wanted someone who he could trust in Jack. There was clearly that bad dynamic with Guy Noves.
Yeah.
So Jack left. It all happened really quickly, although it was the worst kept secret for a good month. Okay. So Jack went, and the president said, "I want you to take over." So,
when he was your boss at Bordeaux, did he seem slightly old school? I mean, you told us what culture you entered into anyway, but I don't know.
Yeah, he was very French. So. But it was me, Jeremy Davison, and Joe Worsley. So between the three of us, we sort of run things from a day-to-day rugby content aspect. Jack's got a great ability in creating a good ambience, and, you know, making sure there's no ill feeling, which does, you know, have its strengths. But then sometimes I think you can just create mediocrity, and people just cruise, and in a French environment, to give them the option of taking the shortest option to success, which doesn't guarantee you success, or saying, look, this is going to be really, really tough. If we put something in place now, there's a really good chance that we could win something at the end of it.
I think we probably all know which option they would take. So there was a little bit of, you know, the element of it's comfortable, it's nice, it's good, and it was always amazing with like the president there, and you ask for some extra rugby kit, and you'd have to really, you know, make sure you've got all your detail right and why you want the extra rugby kit and extra different coloured balls, and you ask to take the team out for a social, and you know you get an incredible budget. You can do that
So you'll pay for a night out, but not an extra tackle plan.
Anything around a good feed and a nice bottle of wine, you know.
I think it sounds brilliant.
I remember doing picture research around the time that Rory was coaching there, and some of the PR shots that got used are the players in bins full of grapes, and it looked like that. At least from that side of things. It was a hell of a time.
Yeah. That's the harvest. Yeah, people come out of the woodwork. Even ex-players turn up for that.
Yeah, that's why we're buying oil.
So no. To be fair, Jack's a lovely guy, and you know, it was something I don't think he could say no to.
Yeah.
Of course not. Yeah,
it was one of those where, you know, Bordeaux, where there wasn't, you know, we just all sort of turned up on the first day. It was, you know, going from working under Eddie and the 20s and Saracens, where things are a lot more process driven and thought out, and you know, meetings have an agenda and what we're going to do, where we're going to be in X amount of time. It was I remember cycling across the river with Joe Worsley in Bordeaux on one of the hired bikes from the town centre to a meeting in Jack's apartment. He just had a knee reconstruction, and Jeremy Davison was on FaceTime back in Ireland, and we were planning the pre-season, so it was
that's how you planned it. Planning pre-season.
It was very French. So yeah. And I walked out and I said to Joe, "Is it always like this?" Joe said, "Yep, get used to it, mate."
All right, listen, we'll go back to a bit on French rugby later, but we need to talk about the Premiership weekend. Back in the Premiership, the top of the table looks rather dull because Exeter and Saracens are so far ahead. Bottom has got very interesting again. Newcastle beat Sale, and they're now only 3 points behind Worcester, who are only 2 points behind Leicester, who were absolutely tragic against Northampton. And now we're kind of... I think you can throw Bristol into the mix of possible relegation contenders, but they're another 2 points ahead of Leicester. But there's... how many rounds to go? 5 rounds to go. Can we genuinely see Leicester being relegated?
I mean... There's still a lot of rugby to play, but they were as close to abject as you could get at the weekend. They were, I mean, I'm just going to read out a tweet to you actually from George Shooter, former Leicester.
Well done for finding that, because I read that yesterday. I thought, oh, I must use that.
But. And I quote, and this is about Leicester Tigers: zero leadership from anyone in senior management. Zero acceptance from anyone in senior management. Just excuse after excuse and podcast PR crap. There's nothing against podcasts here.
I thought that was a bit offensive. We love them.
What is the senior management currently contributing? Players and coaches getting the blame, but what support are they getting? Well,
that's the sort of tweet when you're really pleased that they broadened it from 144 characters or whatever you
said. Yeah, I was going
to
say.
Thank goodness, I mean, you can say everything you wanted to say.
That's a former player fired up. But if you look at what was going on the pitch, Leicester have conceded over 100 tries in all competitions, and it's March. You know, that tells you a lot about what's going on there. And they're having problems on the pitch with their discipline. And one of the things that I kept seeing people saying over the weekend was how poor their conditioning looked. And I mean, you could sum that up with a try. When Collins scored after 32 minutes, Leicester's defence looked ragged. I mean, they were all over the shop. This is after half an hour, and it didn't get much better for them. Now you've got to give credit to Northampton for the way that they played, and they seem like they're finally getting a grasp of the style of play that they want to have. And there's guys there that you wouldn't say were superstars before, who are really thriving under Boyd's systems there. You know, we've got guys like Rory Hutchison, who, I mean, some would say, what choice centre would he have been at the start of the season? Absolutely thriving in this current system. And Ryan Achenbigger, Bigger was a big personality at the weekend. I mean, that's how you describe it, actually, a big personality. But, yeah, certainly alarm bells for Tigers.
The season's going to be decided for me in the next 3 weeks. I think if you look at the games all those sides have, and while clearly Leicester are as bad as probably any of us who've been covering this sport can remember a Leicester side being at the moment. You look at their fixtures, they've got Exeter at home, Newcastle at home, Bristol at home. So they've got two games against their closest rivals at Welford Road. Whereas you look at perhaps Newcastle, who obviously were terrific at St James's Park in a big, high-profile, sort of big, hyped game against Sale on the weekend, but Saracens away, Leicester away, Northampton at home, and then Gloucester away after that. That is a tough ask for them. Bristol, Worcester, I was at that game on the weekend. That was just one of the best games of Premiership rugby I can remember. And also just for so many reasons, nearly 15,000, which was actually lower than Bristol's average attendance this year. A phenomenal atmosphere. Two teams who are willing to put width on the ball. They weren't scared or intimidated by the fact that their position in the table meant they had to play sort of one-out rugby. They both played rugby, six tries in the game. Worcester just probably deserved to edge it, but both sides have got quality there. So I still think Newcastle, despite what's been obviously a really good weekend for them, I think I'd still fancy them to go down.
Yeah, I mean, that game from Newcastle at the weekend, I mean, it was impressive the way they bounced back. How much of that is the occasion? How much of that is the pressure that's bringing it? You don't know. But in the first half an hour of that game, Sale were in complete control, particularly in set piece. They were having dominance there. They looked like they were just going to roll over Falcons. And Falcons weren't free scoring. There was a man of the match for Sinoti, who I describe as having more steps than the Great Wall of China. He's at one point he put Faf de Klerk on his arse and then sent Solomona out to buy some milk. This was in a 5 metre channel. It was,
and he's doing what? How big? I mean, was 17 odd stones?
I mean, it's incredible.
He's a big boy, isn't he?
And he's dancing. I don't know what size his shorts are, but they're pretty hefty.
Are they as big as yours?
Well, close.
go on.
But the thing that kept them through was actually a large part was down to Tani Takalua's just grit and determination. I thought he was phenomenal from nine. Toby Flood scored a try where he dragged three men over the line with him, and it was marginal. It's just those are the kind of things that Newcastle were winning those games regularly last season. Yeah. And you know, this has been all too rare for them, and that's where the problem is. So as fantastic as that was and how much of a boon it was, and it was a fantastic occasion, I was thoroughly entertained by it all. They need to be doing that more often with this running.
Do you think the Champions Cup has had an impact on their season this year though? Without that now, do
well,
they?
I mean, probably you'd be better placed to from a coaching perspective to understand how your sort of resources get stretched, focus.
When we mentioned about talking about that, is as much as I don't disagree with all of the points that you've brought up there, I just question whether their experience of playing in the Champions this Cup at the start of the year, you know, will that stand them in good stead playing against, you know, back to back, week on week, playing against some really good teams, and you know, they would have gained some big game experience in that. So,
it's their Champions Cup experience was really extraordinary, wasn't it? Because they took two massive scalps, when that happened, everyone went, well, I think most observers thought, and probably the players and the club themselves thought, well, if we can do that, then we're going to be all right.
Imagine how they reflect on those results in Toulon, though. It's fair to. I mean, we can talk about I'm sure we'll talk about French rugby a little bit later, I'm sure. But Toulon, those results, a bit of a gift. I don't know if those games were a gimme.
Well, I think they're Patrice that came in, so they probably hadn't quite got their ducks in a row at the beginning of the year. And Newcastle potentially being a little bit more organised, or definitely being more organised.
Yeah,
I think they caught them. They caught them there, and then they just snuck home against Montpellier, didn't they?
Yeah, incredible. They would do that. I mean, everyone was sort of, we were all going, oh, isn't it lovely that Newcastle can play in the Champions Cup? And
yeah, I think it would clearly go down to the wire. It will be tight. Tough one to call.
If it goes down the wire, then Newcastle have Bristol at home on the last day.
Yeah, that's a huge one as well.
So, I mean, that could be exciting, but I sort of, as you say, Sam, it might actually be tidied up 2 weeks before that.
Did Dean Richards make a strong claim for quotes with least self-awareness that would play out worst in the press when he called for how his last week, Dean, a long and steadfast supporter of promotion and relegation, suddenly decided to.
He thinks it's a very bad idea.
It's now a terrible idea.
As
commercially, there are so many reasons. And well, if Leicester were the club to go down, surely that would put an end to the conversation for at least a couple of seasons, wouldn't it?
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Rory, in France, we're obviously just, we've been having this conversation about ring fencing and promotion relegation and mm-hmm. scrapping it, etc., for the Premiership. Do people talk about this in France, or is it different because your second division is so much stronger? So if you do get so relegated,
so much more competitive. Yeah. There's still a fair amount of money involved in.
So you're not like falling off a complete cliff.
You're
like
still, you're still supported, you know, financially in second division,
yeah.
televised regularly. So there's a lot of exposure. You know that you're going into what is a competitive league with the opportunity to, you know, consolidate and potentially bounce back up. But you know, I just question whether for the longevity and security of the game that, you know, getting rid of relegation, you know, actually would be better for the long term of, you know,
player development,
bringing players through, coach development. Not saying that because I'm not in a role at the moment, but it's, you know, I think that the pressure of relegation does have an impact on the way you coach, your mindset towards you know, a plan and maybe a vision. Because if it's very short term focused, then it you know, there's certain things that yeah. do go out the window. It's fantastic saying, you know, we can do this, and as we talked about briefly before, play what you see and jouer. Sometimes the reality of it is there's quite a lot riding on it, so the element of risk is reduced, whereas, you know, Pro 14, Super Rugby, it's just a completely different brand of rugby, not just because of relegation, but I think it definitely...
I completely agree with you. That's clearly one of the strong arguments for stopping relegating teams and allowing coaches to build up players. And I mean, well, let's not do that whole thing now because that's another special edition.
Yeah.
Right, let's go on to no one's going to get relegated this coming weekend because we're into Europe, and there's only one English team left in the Champions Cup. The quarterfinals are Edinburgh, Munster, Leinster, Ulster, Saracens, Glasgow and Racing Toulouse. So I think most of us, we won't do a long conversation about Saracens, but anyone wants to disagree that Saracens are likely to win that? Okay, good. We got some consensus there. Leinster, Ulster, I'm going with a home win. I don't think that's a very very brave call.
No.
Edinburgh Munster will be very interesting.
Yeah, certainly off the back of the result at the weekend, Edinburgh defeated Leinster, and in fact, the weekend was an interesting one for there were a number of teams that would been unbeaten in 2019 so far. Leinster were one of them.
Benetton were the other. Crusaders and Cast had all been unbeaten in 2019 up to this point. They all lost at the weekend.
Really?
The only unbeaten side that's still...
Oh, I'm so glad you came on the yes.
The only side that's still unbeaten is Toulouse, who are away to Racing.
You've just stolen Sam's favourite stat. He was about to say that himself.
Tripping off the top.
Sorry, Toulouse are the only unbeaten team left in
Toulouse are unbeaten in 2019, and they won yesterday, so... They've got fantastic form going into an away game at Racing, so we'll see. You know, they're playing away from home.
They've already beat Racing at Racing as well, haven't they?
Yeah,
in the top 14.
So, I mean, that one's going to be fireworks, and that's on Sunday.
Yeah. So, Rory, on that, so Racing Toulouse on the Sunday. So, given what you've said about French club rugby and sort of what we know and what we see, are Racing and Toulouse, are they the anomalies? Are they a more mature or more modern sort of professional culture? Are they different to what we generally see? Or
yeah, I think to start with, Toulouse clearly steeped in, you know, history of success in and around the Heineken Cup and top 14. So big catchment area. It's you know, the town is obsessed by rugby. So I think they are. You know, they're a team that will always do well, just because I think they've got a lot of history to fall back on.
Yeah.
They do it differently to the other clubs. I believe that they are the Jouer team of French rugby, and that's why I said credit to them. They've backed it. They've gone with it. They've not copied anyone else. They've not been influenced by, you know, heavily influenced by a foreign culture. They've got some foreign players there. Coaching staff is French. And they've just said, look, this is what we're going to nail down this year, and we're going to go with it.
Mm.
So, you know, credit to them in that sense. On the flip side of that, I think, you know, the amount of foreigners that have passed through Racing and have influenced the two Laurens who coached there. You know, Dan Carter, who was there last year, probably heavily run the cutter for them, I would imagine, last year. So I think the coaches there have picked up on some of the Anglo way of doing things. The only thing I would say going into that game next week is I believe Racing probably have a bit more big game experience than Toulouse. That current Toulouse squad haven't gone to a quarters or semis yet. They're a new group of players and coaches are doing incredibly well, as we said, unbeaten. But I just feel that potentially Racing have that big game experience that Toulouse don't have it currently.
Yeah, I'd probably agree with Rory on that. I did a piece for the last issue of the magazine all about Maxime Médard, talking about how his resurgence as an incredible player aligns with that of Toulouse. They've been in the doldrums for years, suddenly they pop up. And speaking to quite a few guys, they said the most important influence they have there is on the younger guys. There's a real sense that's an exciting group at Toulouse, but so many of them are learning as they go, and this is all brilliant for them, and they have no fear, which is a big thing. Everyone will talk about no fear, but... who knows? It could be a step too far for them, or maybe playing with no fear for kids is. Who was it that said you never win anything with kids? Oh, maybe that goes out the window. but going back to the Edinburgh versus Munster, certainly that's a fascinating one, because Edinburgh are on a hell of a roll, and you look at the way that they play with Bill Mata, Viliami Mata, in the back row. I've heard him described as the best offloader in world rugby at the moment. John Barclay has spoken about he is the one player he's been excited to play with the most, because all you do is just follow him around the park. Yeah. I mean,
was that before he signed his new deal?
Yes, yeah, probably. And I mean, it's telling that at the weekend when Edinburgh beat Leinster, Duane van der Merwe, who plays on the wing, got zero touches of the ball because the forwards for Edinburgh were playing with the ball so much. And
the whole game he didn't touch the ball.
According to the stats, not a single touch. Which is frightening. Whereas
10-man rugby, maybe.
Yeah. Well,
but Max is a one-off, isn't he? Or he's a two-off if you allow to.
Yeah, well, he plays with one hand.
Nakawara, I think they would have to go into that conversation as best offloader in the world.
I mean, certainly that back row is mouthwatering from Edinburgh. To have
Rory, who's the best offloader in the world? Come on, we need to name him now.
It's not Mike Brown.
That's so unfair.
I think Nakawara at Racing.
I mean,
he's been doing it for longer, hasn't he?
All it tells us is that Fiji are going to be a frightening prospect
seriously,
at the Rugby World Cup. But that back row with Edinburgh, with Mata, Barclay comes back having been out for so long with injury and gets man of the match against Leinster, and playing with Hamish Watson, who we all know how destructive he can be. That's exciting. You put on the other side of that Munster, who weren't fantastic against Ebrae at the weekend, but their maul was an incredible weapon, and I think there could be a bit of arm locking there, and maybe a player like Tagburn comes into the conversation with his jackling before jackling becomes completely illegal.
Can we we'll get on to that.
That's next week.
Can we have Kokonasinger as the best offloader? I mean, he's only done it once, but his offload against Italy, well, okay, it doesn't really count if you offload against
He's got
Italy.
Potential to be. What excites me about that Racing, I think, you know, coming into the, obviously, it goes without saying, as you get into the latter stages of the tournament, you look at who the real, real quality players are in the teams and game changers. I think Finn Russell and Nakawara at Racing just give them something really, really special. Just a 10 who can do things that other 10s can't do.
Yeah, the Russell-Zeebo combination has caught everyone by surprise this season. That's been fantastic.
It really has.
You're looking at maybe a little bit of individuality and a massive experience in the racing squad, where potentially Toulouse have built more of a, I don't want to say they've got more of a team culture or team ethos, but they've won a lot more games on their togetherness and what what they've created, whereas, you know, for me, Racing, just that, you know, that density of experience in big game, you know, players. I think I agree that they probably just got a little bit too much.
Do you see Racing as potential winners? could they? I mean, in my head, I think it's probably going to be a Saracens
really
final. But.
Really, really interesting question, because I always used to ask this question when I was in France. I said, would you rather win the top 14 or the Heineken Cup? And they're like, top 14.
Yeah.
Rory, you've got to understand that it's just about the top 14. So, like, I think with Racing, it's how they. Have they got the capacity to spin two plates, go into the wire, because they've just got back into the top six with their win over Bordeaux yesterday.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's quite a little bit like the Prem, it's very tight. So it just be whether they can go the distance and balance in two competitions, because that the top 14 running is, you know, is pretty hectic, and there's a lot of teams that are going to be coming in and out of cycles, i.e. there's a lot of players that front-loaded the start of the season. Whereas I think Racing have got some guys back from injury, like Montpellier, so it would just be really, really interesting to see how they balance those two run-ins. So I don't think they'll go all the way in the Champions Cup, but I think they'll be there or thereabouts in the top 14.
Mm. Does the top 14 season, Al, you'll know this, finish before the World Cup starts? fact, does it finish? Yeah. Does the top 14 season finish before next season starts? the amount of rugby and the length of the season is pretty extraordinary.
It goes on, and that's just why everyone says let's take stock around Christmas and February, just because of, you know, the pure brutality of the start of the campaign, and then how it's a sprint finish at the end.
So I think just to pick up on your joke, Sam, teasing the top 14 for being such a preposterous competition that goes right into the summer. I think the top 14 final is the week before the England squad will gather to start their pre-season for the World Cup. So, moving on from Jack Brunel, that's another reason why they don't really help themselves from a national point of view. Right, Sam, this is your section of the podcast.
This is my life.
So, Paris, a few bits and pieces have come out from Paris already. They're looking at maybe completely redesigning the Ruck and banning the Jackal, which is one hell of a piece of work. But I think everyone can see that the Jackal can encourage...
charging.
Charging and... it is certainly a magnet for injuries.
Yeah.
They're looking at incentivising a long kick into the opposition's 22 to encourage opposition wingers to drop back and produce more space on the pitch. So those are my sort of main two takeaways, apart from what I said earlier, which was brilliant. They're looking at this whole thing cold. But when you look at what you saw in Paris, what do you think might happen, or what most excites you about what might or could happen?
Those ones that you mentioned clearly sort of stole the headlines as such. I was actually really interested by the fact that the RFU are going to restart this high tackle or low tackle trial, which they trialled in the Championship last year, and everyone had assumed was kind of dead in the water, because it had actually increased the number of concussions that were being sustained by tacklers off nine, because they were essentially bending when looking to employ that lower tackle when actually previously they'd just taken a soak tackle standing up, which was never refereed. But I mean, big picture stuff. That 50-22 kick is interesting. It's essentially everything there was sort of based around this acceptance that there are now too many collisions on the field. The number of tackles has gone up by an astonishing number in the last 10 years. So yeah. Just the amount of time the ball's in play has gone up. The amount of incidents where players can get injured, essentially, contact collisions, has gone up in the game. And whilst injury rates have kind of plateaued, although they are still going up, the severity of injuries has definitely gone up, and everyone accepts that. The number of concussions has gone up, perhaps not quite as much as the data's shown, because there's clearly a greater recognition in recent times, but unquestionably it has gone up. So,
yeah, 10 years ago, concussion wasn't even a recognised injury, really.
Well, hardly. I mean, it's always been within that RFU injury audit, but it wasn't something that was getting reported. Yeah, players felt embarrassed to report it.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
It was the unspoken sort of, you know, brush it away. But it felt to me there were two kind of schools of thought essentially within that meeting, or within the symposium, let's call it a meeting, which were guys who thought that there needed to be radical law changes based upon the evidence that's being built up, this big yeah. data picture which is being built up, and as I said, the RFU have largely driven. And actually,
and what sort of radical law changes were
you
talking about?
Well, certainly the French then. Let's address the elephant in the room here. Four players died in 8 months between April and January in France, and there were the French sports minister was there, Bernard Laporte was there. There is a lot of political pressure in France now to change things, because for whatever reason, which we may never understand, there was this horrible cluster of deaths. You know, obviously one death.
So they want to bring the tackle
down below the waist. You know, but
did they offer any solutions?
Well,
they just identify a problem.
So that well, I mean, that this is the interesting thing, and I think the thing. So just going back to what I was just saying before, there's two schools of thought: you change radical law changes, or you actually tighten up the refereeing and tighten up the how the current laws are.
Oh, okay, so those are the two.
Differing views, and essentially what I have learnt over the last, let's say, 4 or 5 years, and I do recognise and understand, is that this law of unintended consequences. That so whilst there's clearly a will to drive through law changes and make the game safer, like almost everyone agrees that is a good goal to work towards. The risk of making kind of knee-jerk changes is that you end up causing a load of scenarios
somewhere else down the line that
you haven't really thought through. Yeah. And that's why I do have a significant degree of sympathy with people working on the laws. I think essentially a concept or a kind of, you know, something, a direction of travel towards reducing the number of collisions, certainly head-to-head collisions, and reducing the number of tackles made in a game, I think is a good thing, and actually making space more available on the pitch, and essentially stretching defences out, reducing the kind of reward for rushed defence. I think trying to find ways to do that has to be a good thing.
Okay, shall we have our own little Paris Accord then? so we're now in Paris and we're discussing how we're going to change the game. So everyone's allowed a law change or a change to the game or something they do differently to make it safer. Do you want to go, Rory?
Reduce the amount of players. I think.
Ooh.
So take it down to 14.
Love it. Well done.
That would obviously have to be.
Who are you dropping? Number eight.
I thought about that on the train today. Yeah, it's. Could you have it where you have to stipulate who you drop, a forward or back, during the week?
Makes Jack Nowell more valuable.
You can have a draft.
Yeah.
You sort of people bid for what position they get to lose.
You might want to have more forwards during the winter time, maybe more backs on during the when it's a bit of a faster track. If you get a penalty in your own 22, you have to run it. Does that increase or decrease, you know, the amount of collisions? Is that one less scrum or potentially one less driver maul, or does that increase tackles? I just thought about how we could have are we looking to try and increase the volume of play? We talked about volume of play, ball in play. Is that the reason why there's more collisions, because the ball's in play?
Largely, I think.
So do you play 35 minute halves? less players. So much to look at. It's finding out, you know, what you want to increase or decrease, isn't it? Is it ball in play or is it collisions?
The 35 minute halves was a professional game that was started in Perth at the weekend.
Okay.
Global Rapid Rugby.
Oh yeah, of course.
I'm writing something about that in the Times tomorrow, so this is a decent plug for it. But yeah,
I'm going out to Hong Kong to meet one of the teams.
They're playing 70 minute games.
Yeah.
Right, Al, how are you changing the game?
You know, I'd actually like to see what impact because we're talking about ball in play and the idea of kicking. I'd love to see just what happens with this 50-22 or the 40-20 as it was in league. I'd actually like to see the impact of that, because we talk a lot about reducing the number of substitutes, and for me I find that a strange one because the idea of let's keep players on the field. I mean, even as a cursory glance, if you type into Google studies for the fatigue and increase of an injury, there's even just a cursory glance will tell you that there's enough studies going in there that the idea of playing when you're extremely fatigued increases your chance of injury. Now, I'm not saying that's 100% right. It would need to be looked into, but then you factor in, well, you still need specialist front rowers. There's all sorts of moving parts.
If everyone's getting fatigued at the same time, then the theory is that the athlete that you see out on the pitch changes shape, don't they? They become more aerobic athletes, and the collisions are not so colossal, and therefore
that was the interesting one as well. Like, in order to trial that, where do you trial it? Because if whichever territory you decide to trial that, say you run it for a reasonable amount of time, 2 seasons for example, to actually generate enough,
you're asking players to completely recondition.
You're
for
actually
a trial.
Looking for a territory to recondition their players completely for directors of rugby to pick to do their selection for the following season, go out scouting for players at different shapes perhaps. Because as you say, if there are only 3 substitutes, therefore, for example, or 5, then you're going to look at players who are more dynamic, faster, lighter, potentially, which I'm not saying is a bad position to get to, but how do you do it? How do you actually work out if that is a safer, unless you did it across the entire world game?
You could marry that idea with Rory's idea of taking one player off, that when you've hit the hour mark, you take one player off, and then 10 minutes to go, you take another player off, or you give people the power plays. I mean,
you just won't want any red cards or yellow cards.
Yes, exactly. Just swing more punches, actually, and that would clear things up.
The only thing when we talk about the fatigue side of it is, yes, we are at risk of injury there, but also the excitement of the game is that there's probably a fair amount of points scored during during dips in fatigue or momentum, isn't there, as well?
Like, so when England get tired against Scotland.
That's just Scottish brilliance.
Sorry, we didn't do that enough, did we? I should have given you more chance.
Just bring the psych in.
Sam, when you're chairman of World Rugby, which is surely only a matter of time.
It was like the prodigal son returned on the weekend. I must say, I was saying to Alan off mic, but you know, as a reporter or a journalist, when you get invited into something like that, I think you have to constantly remind yourself that, you know, you've got to kind of keep a degree of neutrality all the time, and you know, critical analysis.
You're part of the establishment.
I'm part of the brotherhood now, aren't I? World Rugby brotherhood.
When Gus Pichot becomes president of Argentina, and there's a hole there in World Rugby, I don't know.
The obvious man to put forward, but. Look, I've got to say, I went slightly down on the line of actually officiating things more strongly. You know, look at the current laws as they are, and actually just make sure they're refereed and empower the referees, and not, you know, accept that there are going to be a spike in red cards. Because if you genuinely drive through a sort of zero tolerance approach to contact with the head, accept that there are going to be some really difficult and unpleasant, or let's say sort of what appear to be unfair red cards, but in order to drive changing behaviours on the field, you're just going to have to accept that.
And did anyone explain in Paris?
Not too serious here.
But that happened.
I thought we were taking the mic.
But in a simple way, think of the Sam Warburton red card in the semi-final in 2011 against France.
Yeah, that for me is one of the best red cards ever.
Tip tackle. It was
horrendous. So changed
behaviour.
Every
single person who's ever taken to a rugby field felt horrendously sorry for Sam Warburton. It was just, you know, it was part of the game then, or it had been prior to the build up to that World Cup. You know, it was essentially, was it accidental? Well, you don't see tip tackles anymore, and that was, as you said, I think one of the best uses of a red card. It was brave officiating. It was absolutely following a line to drive the tip tackle out of the game because it was dangerous, and the tip tackle's out of the game now. It's just, you just don't see them. And I think you can do similar things around reducing concussion where you just actually implement the laws better. I like that idea, that 10-minute window where the ref, you know, anything, any threshold of a yellow card, which could perhaps be red,
is given
a yellow card there, and then off the field, the citing commissioner can go and study the video and actually go through the process and get to the right outcome every time. I quite like that.
Right, that's the next chairman of World Rugby with his views on the world. Gents, thank you very much. So we'll wrap up with our God and Goddess of the Week. Though first of all, we're just going to go down the line because I did ask, who you have to name one team who will be relegated.
Oh, God.
And I'm actually tending towards Worcester because I'm wondering what games they can win. They've got they haven't got any of the other strugglers to play, unless you describe Worcester as one of those, which you can do at the moment. So I'll start off. I'm going Worcester to be relegated.
Me too.
Rory's on Worcester as well.
I mean, you had me here for the pre-season and I said Worcester, and then halfway through the season I said Worcester, so it'd be silly of me to change to. I'm sorry, Worcester, but I'm sticking with that. Also, Perpignan to go down in the top 14.
I'm going to stick with Newcastle because I think Saracens, Leicester, Northampton over the next three rounds is pretty brutal.
Very good. And our God or Goddess of the Week. I'll go with you, Sam, first.
I'm not sure of his name, but the Bristol Stadium announcer. Brilliant. Slick Bristol. I think he's at Slick Bristol on Twitter. Calm. Unpartisan, low-key, understated, all the things that we rarely associate with stadium announcers these days.
You're being serious? I thought you were being sarcastic.
No, he was
fantastic. At Slick Bristol.
At Slick Bristol on Twitter. What a man. If every stadium announcer was like him, all our lives would be better.
Be getting some followers.
Ow.
Well, I haven't been on for a while, so I wanted to give Cornell Hendricks a shout-out for coming back from heart problems that he thought would end his career. He's playing for the Blue Bulls at the moment. Steve Tandy, defensive coach at Waratahs, what a reinvention he's had. They beat the Crusaders at the weekend. But my goddess of the week is Stormy McRae, who's not a household name, although it is a fantastic name. She is the coach of Jordan Women's Sevens, who are going to be playing their first test next week against Qatar and Lebanon. So rugby expanding into new markets.
Oh, well done.
New parts of the world.
Yeah, no, we like that.
I'm going to go with Dan Bigger. Thought he was exceptional Friday night, both on and off the ball. Defensively led his team really well, and to come off the back of probably quite a heavy couple of days post, you always give someone credit who can back it up after a couple of days celebrating. So for
and
me,
he actually Bigger. Hadn't had you wouldn't say that Bigger's had a great season for Northampton yet. That seemed to be his best game, and as you say, to pull it out at that point after he'd been on it for a couple of days, very impressive.
He kicked a 50-22 as well, the first official one.
All right,
well played to him.
Well, so he knows the new rules.
Yeah,
just after Sam's changed them. gents, thank you very much indeed. This was the Ruck, and we will be back again next week as usual. Thank you very much,
you.
Rory, Al, and Sam. Great to see you, and to all our listeners. Back in a week's time. Thank you very much.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.